This is Joe Lee speaking at the 1978 New Hampshire Regional Convention.
On behalf of the New Hampshire State Assembly, who is hosting this year's 8th Northeast Regional Convention. You can't hear me? Oh, okay. Joe, you got to speak into the microphone. I have a few brief announcements, and they will be brief, before I turn the meeting over to Tilly. First of all, the past delegates association, which is the General Service Conference delegates, will have a breakfast meeting in the VIP room, which is on the right-hand side of the dining room as you go in. Don't get any ideas because that's the VIP room. These are the people who are responsible mainly for this convention. There's a list at the registration desk. If anybody hasn't signed it, I would appreciate it if you did. On behalf of the management, I would like to request that you eat at the same table that you did tonight throughout the weekend, if possible. You know, if you don't want to, I don't care. But they would like it. Yeah. Don't come to me. There will be ice cream and soft drinks available at the coffee bar from now on. If anybody wishes them. And for the golfers among us, there will be a tournament tomorrow. You can sign up. It's under the cashier's sign at the main hotel desk. You can sign up for starting times, and you can sign up for the tournament in the pro shop, weather permitting. Once again, I welcome you. I hope you had a good time. Has everybody got a full stomach? Yeah. Well, is everybody happy? Yeah, all right. Okay. If you're happy, I'm happy. And at this time, I would like to turn the meeting over to Tilly M.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tilly McNulty, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. I, too, would like to welcome you all. Oh, it's such an awesome feeling up here, looking out. Somebody asked me if it bothered me to speak in front of all the people, and I said, no, it's not the people that bother me, because I can't see a thing unless I put these on. So I see nothing. We'll open this meeting in the usual manner with a moment of silence. Use it as you wish. I'll read the preamble, if I can see it. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I did it. We are privileged this evening to have a speaker from Texas, big state of Texas, city of Tyler. And I have to apologize to Joe that we can't serve him grits in the morning. But our delegate Woody promises that next year they will have him at Ocean City. And you know, also some of the girls, Joe, were saying they might change their name to like Ellie Mae or Tilly Mae or Mary Jane Mae. Without taking any more time from Joe L. from Texas.
My name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Don't want you to miss a word of it. Over here? Can't hear it over there. Is there anybody on the controls back there? Where'd that drummer go to? These things are like an old barroom spittoon. If you don't get the proper aim on them, you can make a hell of a mess, you know. Yeah, can you hear better now? Somebody. I get it. I get it over here. Yeah. God, I'm glad to be up here with you Yankee folks. I knew that one day you'd have to send to Texas to get some help. I feel somewhat abashed in these surroundings, these august surroundings here. This is real posh-posh, and I'm not used to it. I'm just a clod from East Texas, and I've made AA meetings and cow lots and jails and various and sundry other places, but this is real high class here. Even though it is rather old, they brought me in a day early to try the food out on me. So the fact that I'm still here is quite a great moment. Now, I don't really know how to get started to be the first out of this chute, but I say that one of the greatest payoffs in Alcoholics Anonymous is the ability for us to be with old friends. These are things that we never had when we drank. And here I come up here and meet a lot of people that are near and dear to me. I see one out here that I haven't seen for ages, and the boy from Canada, Flanagan, and the whole caboodle of them. And it's a great thing, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, we get this as a promise out of our big book. So it's something to be very proud of. To get to be with old friends. Up? Well, is that fella back there fooling? Hey, something's happened here.
Talk about it directly.
Either that or
it's got a limber right there.
Either that or if you want to...
Huh?
Yeah, try this one. Too.
How about that? Is that all right? Is that better?
Here. You have to talk directly
on it. Here, wait a minute. Let me turn this on.
All right.
Will you? And you can hold it in your hand.
Oh.
No?
That's a hell of a note. You get a high-powered speaker like me down here and give him a $3.50 microphone. Damn. Can we hook this up? I've had it.
Try the one hand.
How about that? Can you hear that now? Can't hear it now? Oh, God, I hate to stand here for
that. That's good.
Can you hear that?
Yes.
Well, let's go out in the yard. I'll try again. You're not getting it?
Keep the hand right.
Huh?
Listen.
1, 2, 3.
I'm going to feel silly doing this.
You want to put one here?
But I... Can you stick it up on?
Yeah, put it up. That's better.
Yeah. How about that? I don't pick up anything any heavier than a knife and fork. You know, having this thing around here. Now we get started, I hope, for God's sake. Is there any way to please this thing? I think I've been victimized. Anyway, let me try it another way. Let's get it up here closer. I bet this is going to work. How about that? I'll get right in it. Right on there, you know. Now I forgot what I'm up here about. Okay. I suspect that we're here to talk about illness alcohol. What? I didn't hear you. Anyway, I'm going to do the best I can. And if you can't hear it, that's your problem. Really, I think that we need to visit. I'm not here really to visit with all these old dingies. I want to talk to the newcomers here. Really, is anybody here? I'd love to see the hands, if you're not too damned anonymous, of the people who are less than 6 months sober or making your first conference. Is anybody here like that? Come on, come on. Surely there's one here. I know, as isolated as we are up here in the mountains, that you could snag one victim to bring him up here. This would be a hell of a good place to start an insane asylum, wouldn't it, Joe? Huh? Oh, you are. Like you, yes. Yeah, I thought we were lost completely up here. This would be a good place to start an insane asylum. Yeah, let him. I'd have to tell you a story about a psychiatrist in a nut house. I used to go to those. You know, you wonder what people talk about at AA conventions. And I heard three conversations out here about insane asylums we've been in. You know, they get to compare notes, and it becomes a status symbol around here. And this psychiatrist was walking around the yard of one of these parlors for the peculiars, and he came upon a nut laying a row of brick, and he was amazed at what he saw. The nut was doing it with great alacrity, if that's a good word, and it was a thing of symmetrical beauty, this brick laying that he was doing, effortless, if that's a good word. And the psychiatrist said to him, "My good man, are you crazy?" And the nut says, "Oh, no, I'm not crazy." He said, "My people resent me, and they've had me committed to this institution." And the psychiatrist was impressed. And he said to the nut, "I'm on the board of this hospital, and comes next Thursday, I will sit on the board, and I think I'll intercede in your behalf. And we'll see if we can get you out in society where they need you. Would you like that?" And the nut smiled. So the psychiatrist turned to walk away, and he'd gotten about 10 steps, and the nut picked up a brick and hit him right in the back of the neck with it. And he went to his knees. And when he finally staggered back to his feet, he looked at the guy and he said, "What'd you do that for?" And the nut said, "Well, I just didn't want you to forget Thursday." For the benefit of the newcomer, let's talk about, for a little while, how an alcoholic feels. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on account of the way I felt. And I didn't hear any of some of the garbage that we hear nowadays, you know. And how many of you felt bad when you came, you know? It's really a bad thing, the way we feel. And really, I don't know a great deal about the expertise of describing alcoholism. I think society labors with the misapprehension that if we can describe alcoholism well enough, the drunk will quit drinking. But he refuses to do it, you know. He just won't quit drinking after you've explained it to him. And one of the questions that's asked me so often by the non-alcoholic public is, what is an alcoholic? And I can't tell them, you know. Well, what do you know about alcoholics? And I say, well, there's one thing I know for sure, that alcoholics drink more than non-alcoholics. And no matter what your genetic background may be, if you don't ever drink any whiskey, you will not become an alcoholic. So what I'm trying to say is that I believe drinking has something to do with us being in AA. I just believe that. I never have met anybody that didn't drink that came here, really. So that's about as much as I know about it. And down through the years, I have seen a great change in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I came to AA, there was a great stigma on us. And we were so ashamed of being alcoholics. And I love to think that most of that has been removed, really. Don't you think that it's gone away? To some extent. But if you're coming in AA to make any points about being completely forgotten as an alcoholic, forget it. Because there is still a little bit of a stigma on alcoholism. The public can never understand us. Why we get up in the morning and set about to destroy ourselves repetitively. So, to show you that there is still a stigma on alcoholism, I have a nephew that's a psychiatrist in Dallas, and I have another nephew that's a homosexual in San Francisco. And my people brag on them more than they do on me, and I'm an alcoholic. So, I don't know about, you know, who is and who ain't. I can tell you quickly what an alcoholic is not. Maybe we can go into the back door and do this. Recently, I was on a plane going out to Las Vegas to hold services. And there was a fellow got on this plane, a very impeccably dressed gentleman who reeked of affluence, and he sat down next to me and did the goddamnedest thing you've ever seen in your life. It was amazing what he did. Let me tell you what he did. When the stewardess started hustling the booze, he ordered one of those big double frosted beautiful things, you know. And she brought it to him. Aren't they beautiful? And do you know what he did? He set that drink on his tray and began to read. And he likes to drive me out of my mind. I'd say, drink it for God's sake. And do you know that when the stewardess picked up to the trays for to bring dinner, she took away part of that drink? Now the difference is this. She said to me, "Mr. Lee, would you love to have a drink?" And I said, "No, ma'am, I have to be home in February." Then she said to me, "I don't understand." I said, "You never will." So, you know, we can't point at anyone, say they're an alcoholic. Years ago in our society, I understand we have a fellow here from General Service, they put out a pamphlet called 44 Questions. Is that what it was, 44 Questions? Little, oh, they were sterile, innocuous questions, you know, little gentle questions like, "Did your boss give you that look today?" Or, "Did you fall off of the sofa more than once?" Little questions like that, that were not applicable to my particular case of alcoholism. And they were really, you know, and you answered 44 of them, and you didn't know what the hell you were answering. And sometimes you were, and sometimes you weren't. Now, I have some questions here that I have contrived that I think it'll take less than 44 to see where you stand. Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? He knows. Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving? Have you ever had malfunction of the zipper? They used to call me Rusty. Have you ever been so nervous that you could lay in bed and listen to your hair grow? Now, here's the one that'll separate the men from the boys. Have you ever woke up in the morning feeling rather delicately and lose your glasses and wash your teeth with Preparation H? That'll give you a pucker. I don't think we have to go very much deeper into this. I believe there's some people out here tonight who could affiliate with us with very little inclination. Really, you are. And this is the medium upon which we go. And I think that as I hear the resounding laughter here tonight, I think of one of the lines in our book of experience where Bill said, "Why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered," he said. And this is a treasure that we find in the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a bit of laughter, then we find out we're not such the big one after all. William James, who Bill quotes in our books very much, says that once we must deflate ourselves, that the greatest spiritual experiences come, pardon me, said Roel, from the depths of depression. Absolutely. So we all felt this way when we came to Alcoholics Anonymous. We were absolutely, don't forget this word, defenseless. This is the state that we find ourselves when we come to AA. And this is the state that we must never walk away from the memory of, if that's not a dangling participle. We should always remember, I have to remember, how absolutely helpless I was when AA found me. And that's another story. I'll relate to you very briefly a nauseous story of drinking, as most of them are. I get a big kick out of some of these people who get up behind the podium and, oh, the girls come to AA. And they, some of them, not all of them, and they tell their stories about their drinking, and it seems to me that every time they tell it, it gets a little nicer. And pretty soon you would think that they did all of their drinking in one room, and somebody shot it through the keyhole to him with an eye doctor, you know. Yeah. I'm waiting for some of those old broads I used to drink with to get here, you know. We really put it on. As I said, I'm an East Texas clod. I was raised down in Tyler, Texas. Most people don't know where Tyler is, and sometimes I don't. Nobody goes to Tyler intentionally. Our population is made up of people who have been stranded there at one time or another. And the population has been the same for many years. As quick as we graduate them, they leave for some reason or other. But I was in Tyler as a kid and raised in whatever environment that offers. And here's another thing you hear in AA so very much is when the drunk gets well and he stands up behind this podium and clears away the wreckage of his past, he wants to stay close to any dignity that he can hold on to. So he qualifies everything that he says, and I shall. After he gets through telling the nauseous details, he says, "But I come from a fine Christian family, you know." And I've come to the conclusion after many years that fine Christian families are breeding places for alcoholism. And I was raised in a very rabid group of Methodist folks out in East Texas. And about the greatest pastime we had in Tyler was listening to your stomach growl and going to funerals. This was about the extent of it, you know. But one night at age 17, somebody gave me a drink. This has happened to most of us who have been here. And I did it, innocently enough, I guess, to be one of the boys. Now, there were seven of us that night, and I know most of the other fellows, they're still around, the six of them, and they still remain in that realm of, this nebulous realm of social drinking. If you've ever seen any of it. I never have seen any social drinking. I never did any social drinking. But that's what society uses for a floating term. I have a very humble opinion about social drinking, and that is that if you take the most pious and unctuous old sister out of the church and slap about eight slugs of that Gallo in her that I used to drink, she's going to become unsocial as hell, I'll tell you. No way. But the night I took the drink, something happened that night. I shall remember it if I live to be a thousand. The great exhilaration, this great thing that happens to us that is beyond any human description. And I thought to myself, where has this been for so long? Why haven't I found this earlier? There was not any obsessive instinct there. God, don't let me break that thing. There was no compulsion, but in the back of this fungus that is between my ears, I had the idea that here was a thing to use. And I began to use alcohol. And if I needed to be joyous and happy, I did it. It was the medicine for all of ills. It took me away from the wall. It made me a part of. And I suspect this is the greatest fear that the alcoholic has. Some great philosopher once said that man's greatest fear is that of rejection. I think I had a psychiatrist to tell me that one time, incidentally, and I went to a psychiatrist one time, maybe two of them. It took me away from the wall, and I began to use it. And the minute I began to use it, Tyler became too small for me. You know, we go on to greater things. And the East Texas clod ended up in a place called Hollywood, California, if you can imagine that. And the profession that I got into, I became an understudy for one of the more eminent fashion designers in Hollywood, and the fashion of ladies' lingerie. Here's the clock from East Texas. In the hurdy-burdy life of Hollywood in Beverly Hills, and a kind Jewish man had taken me in and had spent a ton of money trying to educate me so that I would be a credit to him and his firm. And I had all the possibilities that a young man could have. It was a great opportunity. I would love to say here quickly that I have a wonderful future behind me. Now, in this particular profession where you cut these soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that the ladies wear, you girls know, if you have a pinch, don't blame it on me. I've been gone quite a while now. But we have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous, the second step, I believe it is, where it infers that you might have a gopher in the garden. If you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of those places in them, you're nuts. I told a psychiatrist about that later, and you know what he said? He said it was just wishful thinking. Needless to say, I cut myself out of that profession. I really did. Here was the greatest opportunity I ever had. This Jewish fellow was so kind and compassionate, but like all of my subsequent employers, he could not understand why we do it. And this is the barrier between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. I drank with him, I partied with him, and he could not understand why I couldn't come to work the next morning, and why I shook. And why it affected me like it did not affect him. And one day he came to me and said these very sad words. These words that the alcoholic cannot take at all. Just can't stand them. He said to me, Joe, you can't drink. And you know, if you're an alcoholic like I am, you don't like that word, can't. Can't, 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 can't. Don't say it to us. We cannot get over that. I was recently giving a very eloquent address up in the University of Illinois on illness alcohol, and I was standing in the dining room in that place, and they had a sign hanging over on the wall over here that I had to look at all the time I was talking, and this sign said, "Don't take the dishes out of this hall." And I keep talking in my head, turn around over here. Don't take the dishes out of the hall. I have to report to you, I got two of them damn dishes in my den at home. You're looking at a guy that cannot stand don't. You can't. And I suspect, ultimately, I will tell you where those words, you can't, might have had a great deal to do with the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous and its subsequent success. This Jewish fellow came to me, and he was a weird sort of a mocky, and laughing one day, and he said, Joe, you're fired. And he did. He had a hell of a weird sense of humor. He said to me, said, something good comes out of everything. Said, the way you handle those scissors, if you would have been a rabbi, you would have destroyed our whole race. It's a laugh now. It wasn't then. Here's job number one. I would love to say to you that I very recently retired from my fifth profession. Every one of them I went into as a result of being an alcoholic, and I further, in all honesty, have to say to you, every one of them I went into, I was a fraud. Live with that. And here's job number one, the great opportunity. I had even achieved a little reputation of success in those circles, and it hurt. By God, it hurt. And for the alcoholic, he begins a procession of hurting. And if he could give you a reason for why it's happening, maybe that would help the hurt a little, but we can't even do that. When we cry in our pillow at night and say, why does that happen to me? And I suspect that the weakness of self-pity is one of the greatest ailments that we have. Why does it have to happen? Why did it happen to him or her? Why am I the one? And this was the beginning of a procession of that kind of a hurt. The war was going on at that time. I run through this. I went out to the shipyard in California, and I bought a plumber's license out the back door of a union hall. And I went into the shipyard as a master plumber. And here's a guy that's never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors, and I go in there as a master plumber. And those were the days when you were frozen to your job. Here we go again. You can't quit. You're frozen to your job. Well, that's an insult to any alcoholic. Do you know that? They said that I couldn't quit. I'd love to report to you that I have hanging in my den at home now a very pink and impressive looking document. It is signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. Who can't quit? Who can't quit? Now, somewhere along the journey of ours, this little journey that we take, we run into these words, and I'm sure that the Al-Anon has heard them. Honey, let's go somewhere else. Let's move from here, where nobody knows us. And we'll start all over again. Has any of you here ever heard that? And he begins the movement. We call it, laughingly, the geographical treatment for alcoholism. And I suspect that there's not one of us who hasn't sucked on that flitbot long enough to make a move as long as the result of being an alcoholic. And I did it. And we went to Sacramento. And I love to hear guys get up here and compete behind this podium about the bad things that have happened to them. And sometimes it gets rather competitive among us, you know. The last guy is the one that wins the brass ring, you know. Now, I can win this contest hands down right here, and we won't hear any more about bad times. I moved from Los Angeles to Sacramento, and I was run over by the welcome wagon. You can't get any worse than that. And I went to work of all places, and where is my red-faced friend? There he is over there. Of all places I went to work for was the railroad. And I say that with tongue-in-cheek, you know. Those are the most narrow-minded people I have ever come in contact with. Really, they are. They have a rule about drinking. They say that if you're seen coming out of an establishment that dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be fired. I never came out very often. And if I did then, it was through duress and coercion. I was flying through the air. You couldn't identify me. But I guess these folks were justified in their attitude about drinking on the railroad. They run more than one train on a track. I never have quite understood it yet. As long as I worked for the railroad, I never did quite understand how they ran more than one train on a track. And I sat with sometimes sheer horror, and I knew that one day, whatever they figured out for me wouldn't work. And then they made the mistake up in the Sierra. Maybe you'll recognize this vernacular. You're up in the mountains here, the railroad people. We went over the Sierra Nevada mountains, and we went up to 7,000 feet. We used a lot of helper engines. And when we got to the top of the mountain, we had to cut the helper engines off. We didn't need them anymore. So the railroad company hung a sign. They use bulletins, railroads do. You know, they'll hang a bulletin on the backside of an outhouse somewhere so that you can't see it. And then if you break that rule, they'll fire you. And, you know, if you raise hell about it, they say, well, it's on the back of the toilet out there. You should have read it, you know. But they hung a bulletin in their depot, and it read like this. They were referring to the interlocking system at the top of this mountain. They said, it is physically impossible to make a mistake up there. Here comes you can't again. And that sign, like you have driven me mad. I dreamed about it at night. Physically impossible to make a mistake up there in this electronically perfect system where they did everything by lights and buttons. And I worried about it, and finally it happened. One night, by some quirk of alcoholic circumstance, I fear, I got two engines going towards one another. I made the biggest Waldorf salad that has ever been recorded by mankind. And those narrow-minded people wanted to fire me. Can you imagine that? And we had an investigation. Railroads have investigations like the government does, and they're both equally efficient, if I might say, about 20% efficient, the government and the railroads. And I had an alcoholic representing me at this investigation, and he proved a thing that was about a million to one shot, but we got by with it. And they didn't fire me. They gave me 60 days. And I remember the old superintendent, when he came out of that investigation, he was livid with rage. He had been had by a drunk. And he came out of there, oh, he was mad. And he said to me what I suspect a lot of Al-Anons have said to their husbands. He said, I'll get you if it's the last thing I ever do. Now, let us forget the humor of the situation and say, my friend, you don't have to get even with a drunk. You don't have to get even with an alcoholic. If you leave him to his own devices, he will ultimately get even with himself. He'll do it. He has a mechanism within him, as it says in our book, the 12 and 12, that the penalty is swift and sure. He will sicken and die. It's in our book. So you don't have to get even for the benefit of you alcoholics, your Al-Anons, I'm sorry. And anything that you call him, he has already called himself many times. And as he lays in the bed at night and cries in the pillow, trying to find an answer for a problem that he does not even know exists. And he lives in this world of no answer, in the world of absolute defenselessness. And so is the case with me. I get a big kick out of it. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we feel so. There's no description for how small we feel when we've been put down, is there? These are the hurts and the humiliations that we remember. Oh, hell, I might don't remember too much of the physical puking and jumping, but I remember those humiliations and indignities that were heaped upon me, and I didn't have no why. Couldn't get me a why. I needed a why. No answer. I remember one time, I'll tell you this. We were living with my wife's sister in a little railroad town. And bless her heart, she's a fine woman. If you ain't ever tried it, don't do it. But it was during the war, and I was at my worst. And this particular day, I had been in the bar all day, drinking a little and napping a little. Have you ever spent the day in a bar, whole day in the bar? If you haven't, you're not as badly afflicted as me. I helped to open them up and stayed until they closed. I didn't know there was any other way. But this day I'd been in the bar and was, you know, saturated. Drink a while and nap a while. Drink a while, nap a while. I was in what some of these cats called a semi-stratospheric state of lucidity. Is that all right? So in the afternoon, I decided I'd go home for no reason whatsoever, and I live right down Main Street. If I'd have been off of Main Street, I could have never found it. But we live right on Main Street. Everything happened on Main Street in Roseville, California. So I go home this afternoon, about 4 o'clock maybe, and throw myself upon the bed, and any other time, I would have been asleep. Any other time, I would have been out. Any other time, I would not have heard this conversation that went on in the next room. And my wife, in hysteria, cried out to her sister. And she said, "Oh, my God, what would you do if you were living with a man like that?" And her dear sister didn't wait a minute. She said, "Why, I'd poison the son of a bitch." You know that. Do you know how I felt? Do you know how small I felt? I was too poor to hire a food taster. But I promise you that from then on, they ate first. Can you imagine living on a hostile planet, you know, like that? Today's the day they get me. Maybe you know something about the little feeling of a defenseless alcoholic. I'm going to tell you another quick little story, and only because somebody insisted that I tell it, you may shoot me for telling it. But to prove that the alcoholic is completely oblivious to his surroundings once he's in the shell, nothing on God's earth gets in there with him. I read the other day, I'm getting ready to buy a motorhome, and I see where they use the term that this motorhome is a self-contained unit. So are we. We've got everything we need when we go. But we cannot be bothered with outside interferences. And this story has to do with some cats. Mary and I have always had cats. And for years, ever since we've been married, we like cats. We've had some good ones and bad ones and expensive ones and outside cats and inside cats and so on. But this particular time was way back years ago, and we were living in a little town called Goose Creek, Texas. Now, if you look on the map, Goose Creek is not there anymore. I don't know whether I had anything to do with it or not, but it's not there. So my wife went up into Illinois to help her sister have a baby. And while she was gone, I got fired from my job, which was nothing new, really. And the process in those days when I got fired was to go home to Mama. None of you ever did that, I guess. Mama had a good purse and a good place to sober up, and I always started out from there, you know. So I was 300 miles to my mother's house, and I loaded up our few belongings in the back of a little Chevrolet automobile, a two-seater, a two-door thing. And I put a mattress on the back seat and these two cats on the back of the mattress. And I started for Tyler. And I had to go through the outskirts of Houston this night, and it was such a night as tonight. It was cool, it was misting rain. And I saw these arrows that point down in the bar rooms, and there was a sign there that said, 3 pints for the price of 2. And not ever being one to pass up a bargain, I bought the 3 pints for the price of 2, and I headed north, and I was belting this jug. Oh, God, what a beautiful night it was. And I would talk to myself, and the car ran better, And I'd sing a little, oh, promise me, you know. I know none of you have ever done this at all. And I got up to a little town called Cleveland, Texas, to get out and get a chaser for one of the jugs. And when I came back, one of the cats got out. And I knew I dare not come home without this cat. And by this time it's raining heavily, it's very muddy, it was a stinking mess, if you want to know the truth about it, and I chased him all over this little town, finally caught him up under a cotton gin, and I whipped him all the way back to the car and held him by one of his hind legs, releasing my hostility, and I threw him in the back seat of that car, and he did a thing on that mattress that wasn't nice. It was a kind of a Picasso study in brown. Do you think it bothered me? Nothing bothers me. And I closed the doors, all the windows are up, the windows are frosted, the heater's going. Never missed a gear. Started drinking more and singing to myself, oh, what a beautiful night. Didn't bother me a bit. And it... 2 o'clock in the morning, I threw up in the front seat. It hurts me now to even talk about it, really, it does. And at daylight, I drove into this little town called Alvin, Texas, and there were two street lights, a little small town, and I drove under one of the street lights to take a belt on my breakfast. And there was a town clown there, a constable or deputy sheriff of sorts, and I guess it was a long time since he'd had a chance to make an arrest. And he came running out to the car and shouted, "Let that glass down." And he shot his head in that car and said, "What the hell do you think you're, oh my God." And he slowly walked away. And I would say to you, when you put your arm around the newcomers of our society, he really doesn't know how he feels. He really doesn't know how he feels. So I admonish you to be gentle with him. In the very first chapter of our book under the title Doctor's Opinion, he describes our illness in probably less than two paragraphs, and there he says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's too simple for us to see, you know. And then he says, after a time, that's kind of like in the Bible when it says, "and it came to pass." Says, after a time, he cannot differentiate the true from the false. This guy that drinks cannot differentiate the true from the false. He doesn't know how he feels. And the third sentence in this admonishment says, he thinks that he's leading a perfectly normal life. So when the newcomer comes, he thinks that this is, and it actually is, his way of life. So I suppose that our responsibility is a matter of changing things that we can, and changing his idea of what the way of life. So I wonder sometimes the horror that sets upon an old member of Alcoholics Anonymous is the fact that today in this fashionable thing we seem to belong to, that the newcomer may come in and stand by the wall while people are playing games. I came in under those circumstances somewhat, and only got a half a message, and it was absolutely, and I say this very clearly and honestly, the fact that I was so desperate, I suspect that I may. After a time, he cannot differentiate the true from the false. He thinks that he's living a perfectly normal life. Quickly, they ran me out of California. I left there a thoroughly discredited man. Doesn't that sound fashionable? They ran my butt out of the state of California. That is what happened to me. We've got a sign on our board in my AA group in Tyler, Texas, and it comes from page 161 in the Book of Experience. And it reads, "No one is too discredited or has sunk so low that he will not be cordially welcomed here if he means business." Why don't you hang that on your board for a cliche? So they ran me out of California, and I got home, and the story is not very much like the return of the prodigal son. They saw me coming from afar, and threw me in jail. And the here I am, the smart guy, the resourceful guy, the fellow from Hollywood in Beverly Hills, the hot cat, has come home after a 20-year absence, and this is the respect they show for me, to throw me in this pokey. My own mother blew the whistle on me. And here I am in this pokey, hating like nobody has ever hated before. The fact that they threw me in a pokey. And now we won't laugh a great deal. One Monday morning there came a fellow to myself whom I'd never seen before. And he told me all about this society of ours. He gave me what we've come to know as the AA pitch. And I do not remember many of the profundities that he showered on me. I remember one thing so absolutely vividly. He stood still. God, how still did that man stand? And you did not have to hear him say what he was. What he was showed through those bars to me. And he told me about the problem of alcoholism, and he used a term in there that I think we need to use a little more often. He kept saying, "We have found from our experience. We have found from our experience." And I'm going to say very sarcastically here that there's a hell of a lot of difference in sharing your experience than imposing your opinion on somebody. I just thought I'd throw that in just to, you know. And I hated his guts and I didn't want to follow him, but from that time until the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, could I erase the image of that man standing there as peaceful as he did? Somewhere in our literature, Bill said at one time that it is impossible to stand in front of a man and undress yourself. In the manner that we do to convey the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, it is a never forgotten thing, and I believe that so very definitely. I shall give you an example of that that is personal. I'm working with a drunk in my group now, and God Almighty, he's a drunk's drunk. He's 3 months sober. He's got an eye that's been kind of knocked on the bias there a little bit. And he don't have any teeth like me when I came to AA. Now the punchline is here. I went to see that man 22 years ago. And he walked into our club 3 months ago. So we're not in a hurry in AA. No hurry is ours. And we've got the greatest PR working for us out there in the public that no other organization has got, one as powerful as we have. We've got alcohol working for us out there. And in chapter 4 in the book of experience, it says in there that alcohol was the great persuader. It beat us into a state of reasonableness. That's in chapter 4 in your big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after 22 years, the guy shows up at the door. And for this, oh God, I've had more fun in the last 3 months with that damn cat than I've had in the last 28 years of my sobriety. Really. If you want to believe in God, go see one of them sometime. This is where we find the power greater than ourselves. I didn't come to follow that guy. I had to go another 5 months. I had to go back to the West Coast, and my people hired 2 deputy sheriffs and loaded me in a police car and shot me out of town. No family likes to admit they've got one of us, and my family sure as hell had one. I remember one of the questions the psychiatrist asked me one time, said, "Did you ever feel unwanted?" And when I came to AA, I was wanted in 2 states and not wanted in 46 others, you know. And I had to go and let alcohol do the persuading, even with a great message like that. One night in a flophouse in Sacramento, I punched my ticket into Alcoholics Anonymous that night. Unknowingly did I do it. I had had all of me I could stand. I'd put you in the right category a long time ago, but I'd had all of me that night I wanted. And I could never erase the memory of this guy standing in front of that cell. And that night, something within me made me say, "God help me." And that's our ticket to the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked back to Texas, 2,600 miles, and made a jail here and a bridge there to see what that fellow had. And I'm so damn grateful that he came to see me in that jail. And if you remember any words I say here tonight, remember this word. He came unsolicited. I didn't send for him. If you dingies had waited for me to call you, I'd have had to die. Well, you're the most uninteresting, drab-looking, coffee-drinking, cake-eating... Why, I wouldn't have had nothing to do with you. I'm a hot cat. I'm an intellectual. I'm resourceful. And I'd have had to die for that. But he came unsolicited. He was listening to the first paragraph in chapter 7 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it reads, "The surest immunity." That's what we came for. The surest immunity against drinking is extensive work with other alcoholics. This works when all other activities fail, it says in our book. When your prayer group blows it, when your transcendental meditation group blows it, when your sitting and touching group blows it, this works when all other activities fail, it says. And then you get the command, one of the only 2 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's followed by an exclamation mark. And it says unequivocally, I can't see this, carry this message to the other alcoholics. That's what it says in our book. I'm so very grateful that man had read that chapter, and I'm so very grateful he wanted to motivate his sobriety by working on another drunk, and I'm so glad I was that other drunk. You know, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous are open so wide that it's inevitable that every now and then we're going to catch a freak in here. And the object of the game is for you not to be him. I'm so grateful for that. And he took me to my amen. Do I have another 5 minutes? Yeah, okay. He took me to my first AA meeting, and God, it was something else. I'll tell you, it was something else. And to watch a new person grow in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess, is the greatest gift that we have in this society. Now, I learned everything there was to know about AA in 2 weeks. I quit cussing. And I got all the literature I read, and I got what you might describe as God-like. Have you ever seen any AA members who are God-like? And I got a call one night to go visit a drunk, and he had lost his bottle to the bartender, and all he wanted was to get his bottle back, but I couldn't see it. I was so godlike, and I put him in the car with me, and we drove slowly, and I talked with sheer eloquence, and I began to give him the pitch, and his eyes began to water, and I thought, oh God, I'm getting him. And as we drove on, he gently lay his head over on my shoulder, and I knew I had him. Did you ever hear of a drunk puking silently? Every time I've gotten godlike with one of them, they puke on me. You know that. You can't do that. How long do you work with a drunk? I don't know. I worked with a guy in my group for 4.5 years when I first came. Went to see him, picked him up one Sunday morning, and he was just like I was, scurvy as hell, and I borrowed a drink of whiskey and knocked him out, really, to get him to an AA group. I believe any way you can get him there is good. So he got sober, and he stayed sober for 3 months. And then he got drunk. Didn't hurt him so much, he was used to it. But it was a blow to my ego. And I said to myself, he's going to sober up under my direction. And I went and got him again. And this went on for 4.5 years. And he'd go to faraway places and call me collect just to tell me he was drunk. And 12 years ago, he got on for him what was his last drunk. And he called another fellow from our group who's not half as smart as I am. And he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he never took another drink. I used to sit in the club and look at him and say, you ought to be mine. And if I know anything of the treasure that God gives us in Alcoholics Anonymous, I owe him more than he owes me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. What is the treasure? Wherefore is the treasure? I suppose I could stand here all night and tell you things of gratitude, but I don't have the time. But I'll tell you quickly a little story and we go home. This story comes out of another book. It doesn't come from the AA book. It comes out of a book that was written about 2,000 years ago. This is a story that comes from the scripture about a fellow that they called a demoniac. This fellow was sick. Oh, God, he was sick. And they said that he was so wild that no man could tame him. Said that the manifestation of his illness, and they used the word disease in the scripture, if you please, said that the manifestation of his disease was such that they had to keep him in fetters and chains. That's kind of like me, you know, lock him up. And he got so bad, it says in the scripture, this demoniac. Now, the reason they called him that was for the lack of some better verbiage. They didn't have any psychiatry in those days. They called him a maniac full of demons, you know. If we'd have had him today, we'd have called him a bedwetter or catatonic or some other strange thing. And he's a demoniac. And they ran him out of town, kind of like me. And he ended up on the riverbank, eating with the pigs. And if you have the imagination that I have, you can see this dismal scene, the babble, the idiocy, the stench, if you please. Here he is, defenseless. And there seems to have been, at that time, a little carpenter fellow who was going around teaching a new philosophy of love. And this little fellow came upon the nut, and he had a facility that we in Alcoholics Anonymous have not quite acquired yet. He could see no ill in anyone. And he said to the nut, "Are you having some trouble, my friend?" And the drunk and the fellow in his sep-pity said, "Trouble is my name. I have so many troubles that they call me Legion," which of course means many. So the little carpenter didn't say to him, "Are you ready?" He effected a recovery that was as little understood in those days as the recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous is understood in these days. And it had something to do with casting the evil spirits out of the man into some pigs, if you remember the story. And they were crazed and they ran off into the sea and were drowned. That is not the end of the story. It seems that there were some stool pigeons around, like there always is. And they ran into the city to tell these people who had owned these pigs. You know, in those days, the pig business was big business. And they said to these people in the town, said, "You out of the pig business." And they were incensed at this. And as the story goes, the people in the city went back out to see what had happened to their material pigs. And when they got there, here's our second step, if you please. There he sat, fully clothed, and in his right mind. We've got a step like that, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. These people were so incensed at these two, at the loss of their pigs, that they didn't place any value on the fact that one feller got well. They were more interested in the loss of the pigs. Believe you me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we better place some emphasis on the fact that one feller got well. How many of you people came in a bunch? So they prevailed upon him to leave. And I can see this, not having come from one terrible existence and not having the pleasure to enjoy the beginning of another. He was frightened like I was. And he looked at the little carpenter and he said to him, "Let me go with you." The little carpenter broke a rule for us. Everybody that he'd ever helped up until this time, he said to him, "Go on now, don't say anything about it. You were blind, now you see." But he broke a rule for us. And he said to the nut, "What I might say to you, stay here, so that others may see what has happened to you. Thank you so very much."